Chapter 21. Nisha has never suffered serious physical violence, but every time she spies Charlotte around the hotel wearing an item of her clothing, she feels a sensation that she imagines must be just like being stabbed. Charlotte has worn the Chloe Shearling coat in public twice. Once, the first time in that corridor, and again the following Saturday, sashaying through the foyer as if it were hers. 2 days later, she wore Nisha's silver Alexander McQueen dress with the slash at the side to an evening event. She and Jasmine had spotted her just as they were finishing their shift, heading out from the side street as she climbed into the waiting car, and it was all Nisha could do not to cry out in pain. But clearly, this was not insult enough. On Tuesday lunchtime, as Nisha heads wearily to the sandwich platter, she glances through the open kitchen doors and sees Charlotte about to take a seat in the restaurant. And she is wearing Nisha's pristine white Yves Saint Laurent suit. "No," she says, and stops in her tracks so that a waiter almost collides with her and curses. Alex appears at her shoulder. The lunch sitting is nearly over and he is wiping his hands on a cloth. He follows her gaze. "It is the mistress." She's going to spill something on it. Nisha is finding it hard to breathe. "I would never, ever eat in that suit." Alex stares through the door for a moment and sighs. She feels his hand on her shoulder, gently steering her away. "No, no, no," she says, pushing it off. "You don't understand. You don't eat in that suit. It would be like eating spaghetti next to the Mona Lisa. It's white. Yves Saint Laurent, 1971. It's probably the only one left of its kind in the world. I got it from a collector who got it from an exclusive estate sale in Florida. The woman had kept it in a climate-controlled, sealed closet, and it still had the store tags. The actual tags. It had never been worn. You see, that suit is vintage and it is pristine, completely pristine. She shouldn't be touching it, for God's sake, not even touching it, but she can't eat in it." Her voice is anguished. As the doors close, she glimpses Carl sitting down heavily at the table opposite Charlotte, his phone pressed to his ear. "No," she says, "I can't let this happen, I can't." "The bodyguard will be nearby," Alex murmurs into her ear. "You cannot go near her. You know this." She turns and looks at him. His expression is sympathetic, but it says, also, clearly, that it is time for her to walk away. "How is this fair, Alex?" she says as he steers her through to the back of the kitchens. "How? How can they even get away with this?" Afterwards, she realizes that Alex's arm is around her shoulders as he offers her a cigarette and waits until she stops hyperventilating. But before she can consider what she thinks about this, he has told her he will fetch Jasmine. She is not to move from that spot, and leaves. When Jasmine arrives, she folds her into her arms and murmurs, "Oh, baby. Oh, my poor baby." And Nisha doesn't even mind. She calls Carl that evening from Jasmine's. She has been a ball of barely suppressed rage all day. "Carl, you got them?" "Got what?" she says. "The shoes," he says impatiently. "The shoes?" Jasmine had sniffed earlier. "You know the shoes are just a way for him to give you the runaround, right? He probably knows they're the one thing you can't trade, so he's making it look like you're the one not meeting your side of the bargain. What man is so attached to a pair of women's shoes?" Nisha had thought about this, and it made sense. There is probably some bizarre legal stipulation that insists both sides should comply with requests or something. She would be able to find out, except she can't get a damn lawyer with no goddamn money. "Stop playing games, Carl," she says. "Just give me my clothes and the alimony I'm owed, you absolute stinking piece of crap." Ah, the language of the gutter. I wondered how long it would take for you to revert to type. She is briefly silenced. She can see Jasmine watching her from across the room as she irons, her face watchful and concerned. She had told Nisha not to call him, to wait it out, make him sweat a little, but Nisha has spent the evening building a froth of fury and cannot hold back.
You're the one in the gutter, Carl, she yells. I know you're playing games with this stupid shoe thing to avoid paying me what I'm owed, but this is not going to work. No damn judge in the world is going to let you treat me like this.
Have fun finding him, darling, he says coolly and laughs. He actually laughs.
Just give me my fair share. Carl, you cannot do this. I'm your wife.
Give me the shoes and we'll talk.
You know the shoes were stolen. My God, you probably stole them yourself just to leave me with nothing. What stupid childish game is this?
You're boring me now, he says coldly. No shoes, no money. And he puts the phone down on her. She holds hers in her hand, her mouth open. Jasmine appears in front of her and silently hands her a cushion. Nisha looks at it.
What?
She says.
What's that for?
Scream into it, babes. If you make too much noise, I'll have the council complaining again. Sometimes she thinks about the person who took her shoes, just like she thinks about the duck Alex gave her, maybe even now travelling in an endless loop around Battersea and Peckham, still swaddled in its muslin wrappings underneath a seat. Her shoes are probably out there, stuffed into the closet of some over-made-up nightclubber, or perhaps packed in tissue by some resale agency, ready to go to an influencer in Dubai. He will actually love it if she cannot get them back. She hates him so much sometimes that it actually hurts.
I was kind of joking about you missing your clothes more than your old man, Jasmine says, as she removes the last of Nisha's hair extensions in front of the television.
They had started to fall out, matting into lumps where they were attached to her scalp, and Nisha's head feels oddly light and insubstantial without them.
But you really do, don't you? I'm serious. You're not crying and weeping and hating this other woman for stealing your man, but boy, are you mad about those clothes.
It had startled her at first. She looks at Jasmine, considering this for a moment, and takes a tortilla chip from the bowl, waiting for the time it takes her to chew and swallow it. I guess they represent something to me. They're the version of me I fought for.
A version of you?
You don't know what I came from, she says.
What did you come from?
Nisha stares at the television for a while. Then finally, she speaks. A little town in the Midwest where we used to get our clothes from the dollar save, and we were lucky if they were new.
The what?
It's like a discount store, like your Primark or whatever it is, but not as classy. Jasmine lets out a bark of laughter.
You're messing with me.
Nisha shakes her head. She has never told anyone this story. Not since she got on the Greyhound at the age of 19 and left Anita behind. My mom left when I was 2. I grew up with my dad and my grandma, and they thought that clothes were vanity and that vanity was the devil's work. At least they said that. Now I think it was because they'd rather spend any money we managed to get on cheap bourbon. So I had to beg for anything I needed, and anything I got came from the dollar safe where everything smelled cheap, and they always bought me everything 2 sizes too big so that I would grow into it. The two of them were mean, and they were tight. If they didn't have it there, they bought me second, third-hand clothes from Goodwill. Jasmine's look says she cannot imagine Nisha in charity shop clothes. The ones near us were so nasty, even dirt-poor neighbors were too proud to use them. And everyone at school knew you were in Goodwill clothes. They could spot them a mile away and they'd beat you for it. I hated looking like that. I hated everything I ever wore. I would wear my dad's work shirts when I got tall enough because they upset me less than those shitty, cheap girls' clothes. They were at least made to last. Heavy duty. And if you looked like a boy where I lived, bad things were less likely to happen to you. Nisha lights a cigarette, and even though Jasmine doesn't usually allow her to smoke inside the flat, she sees Nisha's trembling hand and doesn't stop her. She is staring at Nisha now, her eyes wide.
So how the hell did you end up married to a millionaire?
Nisha inhales, lets out a long plume of smoke, and shrugs. I did what anyone does. Worked at the local bars until I had some money put by. I looked pretty good, or I had something that made men tip big anyhow. Worked out I could use that, got a Greyhound to the big city, did whatever jobs I could. Cleaning, housekeeping, working in bars, hustled a little, became Nisha. I saw the name in a magazine and thought it sounded sophisticated. Worked for a guy who knew someone in a gallery, graduated to a better gallery, and over a couple of years I remade myself. Learned how to speak without a twang, dropped the low-cut tops and dated guys with shelves full of books instead, turned myself into someone who couldn't be messed with. I met Carl when he came in to buy a painting, a way overpriced Kandinsky, if you want to know, and I liked his confidence. I liked the way he walked into the place like he already owned it. He was charming, he smelt of money and security, and I liked the way he looked at me, like I already belonged in his world. He didn't know your past. Oh, I told him some of it. He didn't believe me at first, and then he thought it was funny. Sometimes I thought he was even a little proud of me for it. Carl loves a fighter, but every now and then, if he was pissed, he would use it against me. Call me white trash or hillbilly or put me down. But I honestly used to think he would never mess with me like he messed with other people because he knew I had already dealt with a life far harder than anything he presented me with. He knew I wasn't afraid of anything. She takes the last drag of the cigarette and stubs it out savagely on the edge of her plate. I misjudged that one, obviously. Hang on, says Jasmine. So you had clean toilets before? Nisha looks up. That's what you took from that story? She laughs wryly. Not since I was 22 years old. Anita cleaned toilets. Nisha hadn't so much as touched a brush until I came here. Lord, no wonder you hate that man. More than you can possibly imagine. She has a sudden memory of Juliana, the two of them sitting out on the fire escape one hot New York evening, months before she had met Carl, sharing a cigarette and laughing, bitching about their boss, catcalling at the construction workers ending their shift. Juliana's throaty giggle breaking through the suffocating heat as the workers call back up to them, her curly brown hair bouncing on her shoulders as she threw her head back. Juliana would have liked Jasmine, she thinks. Another memory bubbles up. The last day she saw her. Juliana's chin lifted. The catch in her voice as Nisha stood in Carl's vast, ornate apartment and explained what Carl had told her to do. The problems it would cause her if they stayed close. So you're choosing this? This is what's really important to you? I'm your best friend, your son's godmother, for Christ's sakes. Juliana had backed away from her, her face contorted. Who even are you, Nisha? Because I tell you, I liked Anita a whole lot better. Jasmine's voice drags her back. Nisha, I knew you were a fighter, but now I see it. You'll get your stuff back, and then some. I have no doubt about it. We just have to work it out. We? Jasmine's eyes open. This Carl is an insult to womankind. You didn't think I was going to leave you to handle this one alone? We're sisters now, you know that. Anyway, I have something to tell you. What? Well, says Jasmine, and then she smiles. I was clearing out Grace's old toys. You know we never have enough room here. And I found her practical joke kit. She used to love that when she was younger. Fart cushions, the fake chewing gum that snaps on your fingers, you know the thing. Anyhow, it had two old packs of itching powder. So, she steeples her fingers together. For the last 2 days when I've cleaned the penthouse, I've left your Carl a little present in his underpants. Nisha stares. Nisha, I walked behind him down the corridor this morning. Oh, babe, I nearly wet myself. He was not happy down there. She stands up and mimics walking uncomfortably, her butt cheeks rubbing together. She starts to laugh at the memory, her eyes closed, hands pressed against the sides of her nose. When she gets it under control, she looks back at Nisha. I got you, babe. We are in this together. Nisha blinks. If she was a different kind of woman, maybe that would be the point at which she threw her arms around Jasmine, cried and thanked her and said she loved her and they were BFFs forever. But Nisha is not built that way. Not anymore. She studies Jasmine's face for a moment, and then she nods. I'll pay you back, Nisha says, for all of it. I know, says Jasmine. Also, I think it's possible you're a genius. I wondered how long it was going to take you to realize. Jasmine says and starts to sing to herself as she leaves the room. Chapter 22. That night, when Grace is in the bottom bunk with her noise-cancelling earphones on, Nisha climbs up, lies down, the ceiling is too low for her to sit, and dials Ray's number. Mom? Hey, baby. She prompts him to tell her the day's news. He isn't sleeping and it makes him feel crazy. The door manager he liked, Big Mike, had an argument with the administrator and walked out. Now, without him or Sasha, he feels like there's nobody here he can talk to. A new girl downstairs throws up secretly after every meal, and the staff don't know, but the downstairs toilets always smell of vomit, and he cannot believe like none of their noses even work. Mom, when are you coming? Nisha closes her eyes and takes a breath. Soon. But when? I don't understand why you're still in England. There's something I have to talk to you about, baby. And I wish I could do it in person, but it's kind of difficult right now. He is silent then, and she winces, filled with fear because of what she is about to unleash on him. Well, Daddy and I, things have been a little tricky between us for a while, and...
Are you leaving him?
Nisha swallows. Kind of. Well, not exactly. He's decided he will be happier with someone else, and I've agreed that this is probably the best thing for both of us, and, well, we're just trying to work out how to do it in the way that will be easiest for you. He is silent again. She puts a hand to her cheek, lowers her voice. I'm so sorry, Ray. I really didn't want you to have to deal with any of this, but it will all be okay. I promise. We'll still be a family, just a different sort of family. He still doesn't speak. She can just make out the sound of him breathing, so she knows he's still there. Ray? Sweetheart? Are you okay? I don't mind if he goes. You don't? A pause. It's not like he's wanted to spend any time with me the last few years. Oh, he does. He really does, baby. He's just been very busy. Mom, you and I both know that's a lie. Honestly. My therapist has been talking to me about honesty and seeing things as they are, and if Dad wants to go, that's okay with me. His loss. There is a pause. I actually spoke to him 2 days ago. I told him I wanted to come home, and he said if that was the case, I shouldn't have been so stupid, and that I was... He said I was a liability, that I couldn't be trusted.
A liability?
It's fine. I told him to go fuck himself. There is a deadness to his voice that makes her stomach constrict. He has been so brave for years, but she knows Carl's rejection is a bruise that won't heal.
Are you really okay, baby?
A long silence.
Ray? I've not been doing so great.
How not great? He doesn't answer.
Okay, give me a 1 to 10 on how sad you feel.
That was what the last psychiatrist advised for when discussions of feelings were too difficult. There is a short pause, and then he says,
like, an 8?
Her stomach flips.
I didn't want to tell you because I guess something was going on with you and Dad, and I didn't want to bother you.
Ray? Ray, I'm totally fine, I promise you, and I'm going to get you out of that school as soon as I can, okay?
We'll get a little place together and it'll be just you and me, wherever you like.
Seriously?
If you want to. And I don't have to live here anymore?
No. I've been putting money aside to get us back together.
The problem is, honey, I literally have nowhere for you to stay at the moment. I'm with a friend and it's pretty cramped, so I just have to get the financial thing sorted with Dad, and then we'll be together. Please, Mom, just do it quickly. I hate it here. I hate it. Being in this place makes me feel like there's something wrong with me.
There's nothing wrong with you. Her eyes have filled with tears. You are absolutely perfect as you are. You always have been. She wipes at her cheek with her palm.
So you're really not upset about Daddy?
Why would I be upset?
He's an asshole. He's horrible to you, and he acts like I don't even exist. You're always on your tippy-toes around him like he's God or something. If he goes and does that to someone else, and frankly, it's all gravy, he can just leave us alone. The pain of hearing her relationship described so brutally makes her feel ill. Oh God, Ray, I'm so sorry you didn't have a better dad. I don't care. Ray sniffs. Like I said, his loss. So, when are you coming? There's the problem. She tells him she's stuck here in England while they sort a financial issue. She figures there's only so much his mind can cope with at once. I'm fixing it, but you're just going to have to bear with me. You know he can be a little tricky. What's the financial issue? Ray's therapist has clearly been working hard. Well, he wants me to give him something before he will give me the settlement. It's just some kind of game he's playing. I'm working on it. What? What does he want? It's a thing I don't currently have in my possession right now. Mom! It's a pair of shoes. A pair of shoes? I know. Why does he want your shoes? Well, my friend Jasmine thinks it's sort of a game, because he knows they were stolen at the gym. He's just playing for time while he juggles his money or something. Which shoes? Typical Ray. The handmade Christian Louboutins, the red crocodile skin ones. She waits for his cry of protest, but Ray is silent. I will work it out, baby, I promise. I'll get some lookalikes made if I have to. He's just being a bit of a pain about it all. But they're the lookalikes. What? Those shoes, if they're the ones I'm thinking of, I don't think they're real Louboutins. He had them made specially for me, darling. Of course they're real. Back when I was home last March, I remember I was in the drawing room next to his study, and he was on a call. I heard him saying, Christian won't do it. You're going to have to get something made up. And then a couple weeks later, he gave you the shoes, and I remember it because he hadn't bought you anything for ages, and I had a look at them afterwards, and they did look exactly the same, but I just thought there was something off. The signature on the sole wasn't quite right, and I didn't think that was the exact shade of Louboutin red on the sole. It was a little brash. What? That's crazy. But why would Daddy buy me fake shoes? I don't know. I remember thinking it was weird, but you really loved them, and he liked you wearing them all the time, and I didn't want to rain on your parade, so I just put it to the back of my mind. Suddenly, she remembers something odd about when Carl had given her the shoes. They weren't in a box lined with tissue paper. They weren't in the soft fabric bag that her other Louboutins were. They came in a black silk bag, unmarked. She had assumed it was because they had been made for her. None of this makes sense, sweetheart. Why would your father buy me fake Louboutins? He could buy a whole damn store of them if he wanted to. And why would he want them back? I don't know, Mom, but can you just figure it out and come get me? His voice grows quieter. Please, I really miss you. I miss you too, my darling. I will get this sorted, I promise. Please, just look after yourself. I love you so much. Mom? Yes? A pause. Are you okay? She lets out a muffled sob, clamps her hand over her mouth. She waits a few moments until she's sure her voice is steady. Baby, I'm absolutely fine. The dollar save. Half the store devoted to farm feed and maintenance equipment, the aisles lined with hoses, strip lights, rubber matting. The other half stocked with essentials, bulk packets of soup and rice, cartons of sterilized milk, kitchen paper stacked as high as a house. It smelt of petrochemicals and despair. She had been 7 years old. It was the first time her dad had made her do it. She walked in wearing the sage green age 9 to 11 padded coat that swamped her, and out again in that same coat, but with several sweaters and a bottle of Jim Beam underneath it. Nobody ever suspected a cute kid to be ferrying stolen goods. It was the only time her dad had ever told her she was good at anything.
They had switched their trips between the three dollar saves in the county, once a week for each, and the only time she had been caught, accidentally dropping her haul in the cereals aisle, she had burst into tears and said she had just wanted to get her daddy a surprise birthday present, and the security guard had laughed at the little girl and said, "He likes bourbon, huh?" and sent her on her way with a packet of Twinkies and told her to make sure she didn't take anything without passing by the checkout lady in future. Her dad, waiting outside in the truck, had laughed, especially when she pulled out the other, smaller bottle of bourbon she had tucked into the back of her waistband. "You see, Anita," he had said, pulling off the top and taking a swig, "people only see what they think they see. You keep looking cute enough, people ain't never going to assume you'll do anything bad." Nisha lies in the little bunk bed listening to the tinny beat seeping out of Grace's earphones below, and even though she has done four shifts and one double since Sunday, she thinks about the shoes and is suddenly wide awake. The white horse, if it's possible, looks even more low rent in daylight. Wilted, spindly, half-dead plant fronds edging over its hanging baskets, its signage cracked and peeling. She has switched shifts with Jasmine so she can head over when it opens at 11. Who the hell starts drinking alcohol at 11? What is it with these English people? She pushes her way in even as the barman is unbolting the door and asks immediately to see the CCTV. "Hold up, I haven't even switched on the till yet. Do I look like I need a drink?"
"Well, why else would you come to a pub?"
He is a young hipster type, his dark hair pulled back into a ponytail and his face already masked in irritation. She switches tack. "I'm so sorry to bother you." She smiles. "I was hoping you could help me with something. I had an item stolen from me a few weeks ago, and I was wondering if there was any way I could take a look at your CCTV.
"You want what?"
She glances up and notes the domed cameras on the ceiling.
"You have CCTV, right?"
She points upwards.
"Yeah," he says, following the direction of her finger, "but I don't think I can just let anyone look at." "It will literally take you 5 minutes."
She puts a hand on his arm, squeezes it lightly.
"You would honestly save my life."
He gazes at her, briefly wrong-footed, and she smiles a sweet, hopeful smile.
"Look, I'll explain. I'm in a bit of a spot. It's really hard. I'm a woman on my own in this country, and I'm in trouble for reasons I can't fully explain, and I need help. I know it's an imposition, and believe me, if it were any other circumstances, I wouldn't interrupt your day. I can see you're busy, but I'm really in need of help."
He's a nice kid. She can see the uncertainty on his face.
"I don't think I can give you the date and time and everything. It will take you 5 minutes. "Yeah, but there's data protection and stuff. I'm not asking for names and addresses. I just want to see if something is there."
"We only keep the tapes for 6 weeks.
"That's perfect."
He frowns, stares at his shoes. When he looks up, his expression is suspicious.
"Who are you again?
You're not police." She laughs prettily.
"Oh, God, no. Do I look like police? My name is Anita. I'm just a mom."
"It's not your bloke cheating and you're going to start some kind of gang war in here?"
"Honey, if my man had been unfaithful, I wouldn't need CCTV to deal with it."
He glances behind him, even though they're apparently the only people in the bar.
"I'd have to show you out here, in the bar. No customers allowed in the office." "I get it. You have to be careful."
When he hesitates again, she looks at his name tag.
"Milo? It's Milo, right? Honestly, you would be saving my life. I just need to locate a personal item. Apparently someone may be on your camera wearing it."
He glances behind him again.
"And you say you know exactly when and where?"
"Friday the 7th. I just want to see maybe an hour's footage from that evening, say 8 till 9. "Stay there," he says. "I'll load up the iPad and bring it out."
"You are a god among men," she exclaims and touches his arm again. "Thank you so much."
She sees his expression soften and thinks, with satisfaction, "Yep, still got it." 10 minutes later, she is sitting at the bar with a cappuccino as Milo scans through the CCTV images with an expert millennial finger, occasionally peering closer.
Are the images are black and white?
She says.
Yeah, though we can zoom in if you see anything. It's quite clear.
Shoes, you said. About 6 inches high and strappy. They're Louboutins. Probably better than any other shoes you'll see in here.
And you say someone nicked them.
And wore them here, apparently.
He peers at the screen.
Shoes are shoes. There are loads of women in heels.
How will you know which ones are yours?
Oh, I'll know. She sips at the cappuccino he has made her. So many crappy pairs of cheap, clumpy shoes. So many drunken, lurching girls and bullet-headed men. She feels a sudden stab of anxiety. This is the final white horse. If this turns up nothing, she has no more leads to go on. And then she sees it.
There, she says suddenly and jabs at the screen. Stop, can you zoom in? That woman there?
9:17 on the Friday evening. A woman with badly cut hair stumbles from the dance floor, her legs and feet briefly visible as she walks drunkenly arm in arm with another woman to a bottle-laden table. Milo rewinds a few frames, then moves his fingers around the screen until they zoom in and the woman's feet become clear. She makes him go in as deep as possible until the image starts to blur, but they're her shoes. It's as clear as can be. She feels a jolt of recognition.
That's them. That is definitely them. Can you scroll up? Show me her face?
There she is. The shoe thief. Plain, middle-aged, her eyes half-closed and her hair in sweaty wisps around her face. With each frame, she wobbles across the screen towards the seat, at one point her ankle buckling slightly. That's her. That's the woman who stole my shoes. She breathes, staring at the pixelated image. This is so weird. Milo shakes his head. She looks up at him.
Don't suppose you have any idea who she is.
He frowns at the image, moves along so that he can see the other people around her, scans back and forth.
I think that's the Uber print lot.
The what?
The print firm over there.
Yeah, look, I can see Joel there behind her. He's the one with dreadlocks. And Ted. They're always in here on a Friday.
Uber print, she repeats.
Can you write that down for me? And then, as he hands her the piece of paper, she smiles, an abrupt, genuine, full wattage smile of joy and gratitude, the kind of smile Nisha rarely bestows in her normal life. And Milo, gratified, smiles right back at her. They gaze at each other for a moment.
I don't suppose.
Don't even think about it, she says, and hops off the bar stool. He is alone in the kitchen when she arrives, cleaning his station ready for the evening shift. He is bent over, scrubbing at a mark on the stove.
Hey, Alex!
He turns at the sound of his name and she runs up to him.
I found who stole my shoes,
she says breathlessly. She cannot help herself. She's beaming from ear to ear and she does a little air punch.
You're kidding, he says. Now you will get your life back.
He smiles abruptly, his whole face suffused with pleasure, drops his cloth, picks her up and swings her round by her waist so that she squeals and her feet lift from the floor. Suddenly, almost without realizing what she's doing, she's holding his face between her hands and her lips are on his. He hesitates just a moment, and then his arms surround her, pulling her in, and his mouth lowers onto hers and he is kissing her back, his lips warm and soft, his skin against hers. She is lost in this kiss, consumed by it. The pressure of his mouth on hers, his strong hands pulling her in. He smells of warm bread, of soap and shampoo. He tastes so good she thinks she may actually want to eat him. She bites his lower lip and he lets out a quiet groan of pleasure, and it may be the sexiest thing she has ever heard. Her hand clamps around the back of his neck, her body pressed against his. Time stops and swirls. And then they hear the swing door at the far end of the pastry kitchen, and they are abruptly disentangling her hand to her hair, smoothing it awkwardly as she takes a step back. Minette carries two aluminium trays of dough aloft, humming to herself, her backside pushing the door as she swivels through. Alex follows her gaze, then looks back at Nisha. He lets out a breath, as if he has been holding it. "Well," she says, as Minette disappears into the pastry kitchen. "Well," he repeats. He looks at his shoes, a little discombobulated. She feels a faint sense of gratification. When he looks up again, their eyes meet and she guesses there is faint color in her cheeks. "You're clearly not a woman to cross." Her smile, when it meets his, contains a hint of mischief. "You'd better believe it," she says. And then she dusts down the front of her trousers, glances at him again, and, because she cannot work out what else to do, walks straight back out of the kitchen door. Chapter 23. The car has died. Of course it has. Four times yesterday, Simon had informed her that in no way was she to be late today. There was to be a strategy meeting at 9, a sales meeting at 10, planning at 11, and head office were going to be at all meetings. He'd said it like a warning, like this was bad news for her. "Phil? Phil?" Kat is in the kitchen, staring at her phone as she eats a slice of toast. "Where's Dad? He's not upstairs." Kat shrugs. "Kat, where's your father? You must have seen him. Probably in the van." She hasn't got time to think about her daughter's coldness, the way she no longer looks her in the eye when she speaks, even though this made her cry the previous evening. She grabs her bag and runs outside. The bonnet of the camper van is up and Phil is underneath it, his upper half obscured. "The car isn't starting?" "Probably the battery. It needs replacing." Sam waits for him to extract himself from the engine, but he stays there. "Phil?"
"What?"
"Well, can you help? Do we have any jump leads? I have to be at work for 9 or I'm in trouble."
"Probably best get a cab then."
She stands there, staring at her husband's back. He's been out here at all hours for days. At first she was quietly pleased. That Phil was doing anything away from the television was a marvel. But there is something determinedly exclusionary about how much time he spends out here now, like he'd do anything rather than spend any time with her.
"You're not even going to help?"
Finally, he slides himself out from the bonnet and straightens up. His face, when he looks at her, is curiously blank. "Well, I can't magic up another battery out of nowhere, can I?" They lock eyes for a moment, and she feels a faint chill at the lack of warmth in his expression.
"Well, thanks," she says finally.
"Thanks a bunch." Without a word, he takes an oily rag from the side of the engine and disappears back inside it. She is in the cab when her mother calls. She has 18 minutes left to get into the office, she has worked out, and makes a series of rapid calculations. If she blames car trouble, Simon will find a reason to criticize her for lack of organization, as if anyone could know their battery was about to die. Should she say there was a road accident? He's the kind who would check up, just to prove her wrong. It's best not to lie. Perhaps she could pick up a file on the way in, says she'd gone back for extra figures.
"You didn't come and clean last week, and I need you to look up some socialist hymns for me."
"What?"
"Socialist hymns," her mother repeats impatiently. "Your father is giving a talk about the history of Jerusalem at St. Mary's, and I pointed out that the Bishop of Durham said that dark satanic mills actually refer to churches, not flour mills, so it wouldn't be appropriate. You know how easily offended Mrs. Palfrey is. She's thick as thieves with the vicar, and called poor old Tess Villiers a Maoist for putting ungodly flowers in the altar last week."
"Ungodly flowers?"
"Anthuriums. Terribly penile. We were all agog. Anyway, your father has done something to the Wi-Fi box thing and we can't get online, so we need you to find some more appropriate socialist hymns that he can talk about, preferably by this afternoon. He's got his eye appointment at tea time."
Sam rummages in her bag for some makeup. Kat had hogged the bathroom and she had had no time to do her face.
Oh, and we've decided we're going to take in a refugee, but there's quite a lot of paperwork and we need you to help us fill it all in. We have to get the stuff out of the spare room so that we can put a bed in there. Actually, I think there might be a bed in there. I'm not sure because of all the boxes.
A refugee? Sam cannot keep up.
It's important to think about other people than ourselves, Samantha. You know, Dad and I like to do our bit for the community, and apparently some of them are very nice people. Mrs. Rogers has an Afghan and he always takes his shoes off.
Mum, I can't do this right now. I'm very busy.
Her mother's tone manages to convey a precise combination of affront and hurt.
Oh, well, it would be nice if you could think of us occasionally.
Sam wedges the phone between ear and shoulder, doing her best to apply a tinted moisturiser.
I do think of you, Mum, and more than occasionally. Look, if you want to take in a refugee, that's lovely, but I haven't got time to clear out your spare room just now, or find socialist hymns. I've got a lot on. I've organised a supermarket delivery for you for Tuesday, and I'll come and help when I can.
A supermarket delivery?
Her mother's tone is pained.
Well, I suppose we'll have to tell the poor, suffering Afghans our daughter has too much on to find them a bed just now.
Mum, nobody's seen the bed in your spare room since 2002, when Dad started piling his eBay train set collection on top of it. I'm not even sure there is a bed. Look, I'll come when I can, I just have a lot on.
We all have a lot on, Samantha. You're not the only busy person in this family, you know.
Goodness, I hope you don't speak to Phil like this, no wonder he feels so neglected.
She is 4.5 minutes late. For the look Simon gives her as she hurries into the meeting room, it might as well be 4 hours.
Nice of you to join us, he says, glancing at his watch, raising his eyebrows and then looking at his colleagues to make sure they register it.
She thinks about cancelling lunch with Miriam Price all through the second meeting. Simon is relentless, questioning her figures, looking distracted or bored or tapping the end of his engraved biro on his notepad whenever she speaks. Sometimes he even mutters to himself as she's talking. She sees the way the Uber print managers, who all look like him and dress like him and talk like him, watch this performance and observe her weakness, mark her out as dead meat. When the sales meeting is finished, she goes into the ladies and presses her face hard into her hands so that nobody can hear her crying in the cubicle. While she is sitting on the loo, she texts Phil, who does not reply. He only responds to 1 in 3 of her messages at the moment, and she is no longer sure she can blame depression. She texts Kat, who answers simply, "He's fine." No kiss at the end. No questions about her day. Some days it's hard to feel like anyone even cares if she exists anymore. She makes to text Joel, but it feels somehow too much, an admission of need she doesn't feel comfortable making. Her fingers hover over the keyboard of her phone, and then she hears someone come into the next cubicle and puts it back into her pocket. By the time she emerges, it is already 11:45, too late to cancel. So she splashes water on her face, reapplies her makeup, and heads out to lunch, ignoring the pointed stare of Simon through the glass of his window as she leaves.
Sam, how are you?
Miriam is already at the restaurant. She is sitting at a table by the window. As the waiter shows Sam to the table, she stands momentarily and gives her a warm smile. The print job had gone smoothly, and Miriam had been very satisfied with every aspect, calling her personally afterwards to thank her for her attention to detail. In other times, she might have fed this back to her superior, but there was no point with Simon. He would have found something to pick holes in, or asked her why she hadn't charged more.
Lovely to see you again, she says, and holds out her hand for a slightly awkward shake.
Miriam is dressed in a rainbow-striped jumper and pencil skirt with heeled ankle boots. Sam would never have felt she could wear an outfit like that to work, yet on Miriam it just looks authoritatively quirky. She has, slightly guiltily, worn the Chanel jacket, given it is Miriam Price and she needed to feel pulled together, instead of the black trousers and grey jumper that is her usual work uniform.
I wore my Louboutins in your honour, says Miriam, angling her foot so that Sam can see.
She glances down at Sam's feet, and Sam thinks she detects a faint flicker of disappointment at her plain black pumps. She immediately wishes she'd worn the shoes too.
They're gorgeous, Sam says.
They chat briefly about the weather and their daughters, then compare preferred choices on the menu. Miriam decides on a salad starter and fish, and Sam orders the same salad and a vegetarian tart, which happens to be the cheapest main course. She is slightly worried that she will have to pay for this lunch, as Simon has been clamping down on work lunch claims. She is already calculating what it might come to.
"So tell me about yourself, Sam," says Miriam, "and how you ended up at Greyside. Oh no, I should call it Uberprint now, right?"
She has this air of confidence when she speaks, like she knows innately that anything she says will be right.
"I'm not sure. There's much to say."
Sam stumbles, and then when Miriam waits, smiling, "I mean, I didn't intend to work in print, but I got a temporary job as a secretary there when my daughter was small, and there was a lovely boss, Henry. He's retired now, and he seemed to think I was good."
Here she gives a nervous little laugh in case she's sounding big-headed. "After a couple of years, he decided to put me in project management, and we sort of built up my role from there. He was a very nice man. A good man."
"Oh, I met Henry a couple of times," Miriam says. "I liked him enormously. And what about your family?"
"Husband, a teenage daughter, as you know, and that's it, really. Just us. Plus a couple of needy parents."
"Oh, we're at that age, aren't we?" Miriam says. "Mine are in a care home in Solihull. I feel like I spend my life on the motorway or trying to pacify fed-up carers."
"Really?
I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry if it's not nice for them. Or you." Sam backtracks quickly. "But I don't know, obviously. Maybe it's a very nice place. I'm sure you'd only put them in a nice place."
"It's nice enough. But I don't think anyone really sets out to end their days in a care home, do they?"
Sam pauses as the waiter puts the water in front of them. "My parents say they'll die rather than end up in one, which basically means me doing all their household tasks, cleaning and shopping." Miriam nods wryly. There is a shorthand in women this age, Sam realizes. There is none of the sharp elbows of their 20s and 30s, not an ounce of competitiveness. By their late 40s and 50s, they're all survivors of death, divorce, disease, trauma, of something.
"That's tough on you," Miriam begins.
Sam's phone starts to buzz.
"I'm so sorry," Sam says, cheeks flushing as she reaches into her bag.
Miriam waves a hand as if it is of no matter. Her heart sinks as she sees his name.
"Simon?"
she says, trying to muster a smile.
"Where are you?"
His voice is terse.
"I'm with Miriam Price. It's in the calendar. I told Genevieve twice."
"The Dutch job needs to move up 4 days. They said they've emailed you but had no response."
"What? Hold on."
She mouths another, "Excuse me," at Miriam and puts him on speaker while she opens her email. There it is, 15 minutes ago. An email from the Dutch textbook firm asking for the job to be expedited more swiftly.
"Simon, it only came in 15 minutes ago."
"And?"
Sam swiftly takes her phone off speaker and holds it to her ear.
"So I hadn't seen it. I'll get onto it, obviously, as soon as I'm back."
"You need to be on top of your email, Sam, I've told you. We at Uberprint have a reputation for swift responses. This isn't good enough."
I'm sure they'd understand that someone might be getting lunch at 1:15.
"This isn't a bloody holiday camp, Sam. I don't know what it's going to require for you to take this job seriously. You'll have to come back. Actually, no, you can't, can you? Not without looking unprofessional to Miriam Price, and we need that job. I'll get Franklin onto it."
"But that's my project. I brought it in."
"Irrelevant." Simon cuts her off. "It's not enough to just bring jobs in. I need someone who can deliver the whole package. See me when you come back, after your nice lunch."
As he says these words, she knows there are people in his office with him, can picture him rolling his eyes at the phone. He ends the call and she is left, stunned, at the table.
"Everything all right?" says Miriam, who has been studying the menu.
"Fine. Fine."
Sam pulls herself together. "Just work stuff. You know how it is."
"I know how Simon is." Miriam lifts her gaze over the top of the menu. "That's Simon Stockwell, right?"
Sam stares at her.
odious little man. He worked for us a few years ago, you know, back when he was starting out. I had his number straight away. Is he giving you a hard time?
Sam is frozen. She doesn't know how to answer.
No, no, everything's fine. Just fine. There's just a lot going on. It's just been...
Suddenly, abruptly, she is sobbing. Huge, salty, unstoppable tears pouring down her face. Huge gulps hiccup out of her, her shoulders shaking, her palms pressed to her eyes.
I'm so sorry,
she says, mortified, mopping at her face with her napkin.
I don't know what's happening.
Oh, God. And now she has ruined the lunch, and Miriam Price will think, will know, she is the loser Simon has always had her down as. She glances around desperately, trying to locate the ladies so that she can escape. But she does not want to have to ask, and she is afraid of getting up and heading in the wrong direction. When she turns back, Miriam is watching her steadily.
I'm so sorry,
she says again, wiping at her eyes. Miriam's face is serious.
It's just been a tough time. I'm mortified. I'm not normally...
Miriam reaches into her handbag and pulls out a pack of tissues. She passes them across the table. Mum's handbag staple, she says. You don't even want to know what else I've got in here. Two sets of car keys, my wife's nasal spray, a prescription for my daughter that she doesn't want to pick up herself, HRT, dog treats. It's endless, right? She smiles, rattling on about nothing, giving Sam the space to mop herself up. Sam scrabbles in her bag for a mirror, but Miriam interrupts. You're fine, she says. No smudges.
Really?
The sobs have subsided to sporadic hiccups. Sam feels herself curl over with embarrassment.
You know, says Miriam, refilling her water, I hope this doesn't sound horribly inappropriate, but when you walked in here, I thought the stuffing had been knocked out of you. You looked like a completely different woman from the one I met before.
She hands Sam her glass, waits as she takes a sip, and I'm guessing at least 50% of that is Simon Stockwell. She leans forward. You know, the best bit about menopause, just in case you haven't got there yet, is that you genuinely don't give a fuck anymore when you're dealing with men like him. And they know it. And when they know you're not intimidated by them, they somehow lose all their power. Sam smiles weakly.
Except when you depend on them for your job.
You're very good at your job. Why would it be dependent on him? Sam wants to talk, to tell her the myriad ways in which Simon has made her feel useless, redundant, the many times a day in which she feels ignored or undermined. But it seems unprofessional to tell a client about how it has been since Uberprint took over. And what gay black woman wants to hear a middle-aged white woman whinging about how hard she finds the workplace? She musters a weak smile.
Oh, it's not just him, really. It's been a tricky week.
Miriam watches her. You're being admirably discreet.
There's a lot going on.
There always is at this age. Oh, good, here's our food. You'll feel better once you've eaten. The whole time they eat, Miriam continues a slightly one-sided conversation, drawing Sam out on the capriciousness of teenage girls, the exhaustions of elderly parents, the necessities of treating yourself. She nods here even though she can't remember the last time she treated herself to anything. And Sam carries on a parallel conversation in her head, in which she tries to analyze how bad this is going to be for her. Whether Miriam Price will reveal how this ridiculous woman burst into tears at a client lunch, whether Simon is going to dress her down in front of everyone in the awful glass office when she returns. The thing she feels saddest about is that her memory of her first meeting with Miriam is now spoiled. The woman she had been in the Chanel jacket and heels has evaporated, leaving the real Sam in her place, squashed, defeated, pathetic. She dares not look at her phone, knowing there will be a string of furious texts from Simon about her failings on the Dutch job. So she smiles politely and tries not to sound stupid and picks at her food, some distant part of her observing that remarkably she no longer has any appetite at all.
Pudding? She is dragged back to the table.
Oh, no. This was lovely. But I think I should probably head back to the office to see what's going on with this job,
she says, declining the menu.
I'm so sorry again about...
She waves a hand vaguely in front of her face, trying to dismiss it. There is a long silence.
Sam, says Miriam, this is no way to work.
I know, says Sam, blushing. I am going to sort myself out, I am. I promise, I'm not normally this.
You misunderstand me, says Miriam. I mean working for a boss who is so clearly grinding you down. You're good at your job. I mentioned you to Ivan over at Drake's and he said you've always been incredibly thorough and a pleasure to deal with for that matter.
Sam lifts her head slowly.
We're always on the lookout for people and I was very impressed with what you turned around for us. I think you should come in and meet our team.
Meet your team?
You should be somewhere where you can get your mojo back, wherever that turns out to be.
Miriam signals to the waiter and holds out a credit card before Sam can say anything.
Might you be interested in talking to us?
Sam is so stunned that she can barely speak.
Yes, that would be great.
Good. I'll email you with a date.
Miriam is standing up. She taps a card on the reader proffered by a waitress while Sam sits digesting this. Then she tucks her wallet into her bag and leans forward. In the meantime, put on some really great shoes with that jacket and a red lipstick and let Simon Stockwell know you are not to be messed with.
Chapter 24. The coffee shop gives a clear view of the back of the printworks, a small litter-strewn yard flanked by a Co-op grocery store, the White Horse Pub, and an office block that appears to have been vacated several years ago, judging by the grubby windows and graffiti-strewn walls. Nisha, who was marked off this afternoon at short notice,
0 hours contracts, Jasmine had sighed,
sips a lukewarm cappuccino and watches the battered white vans reverse in and out under the Uberprint sign, the groups of men who gather at the rear entrance, chatting or drinking from mugs of tea between loadings, their laughter sending small puffs of steam into the cold air. She is taut, focused, half waiting for the woman to walk out in her shoes, even though she knows this is unlikely. She has sat here for almost an hour now, picturing a dozen different outcomes. She follows the thief to her house, confronts her, wrestles the shoes from her feet, though that means the woman would have to be wearing them and she feels icky about touching someone's feet. She calls the cops, though if they're anything like US cops, she might as well whistle. She breaks into the woman's house when the woman is asleep, locates the shoes and escapes, perhaps wearing a face mask. This is admittedly a risky strategy, especially as she doesn't know who else might be in the house. Plus, a face mask will make her itch. Where do you buy a face mask anyway? There is always the trump card. She could tell Carl, and he could send Ari in to get them. But she is not sure she trusts Ari to tell the truth about whether he's got the shoes. He could just as easily spirit them away and leave her in a worse position than before. And there is something about Ari and these shoes that just doesn't sit right. Nisha sits and considers all these factors, and the dregs of her coffee grow colder. Finally, when the barista comes over for the third time and pointedly asks her if she wants another, she picks up her coat and bag and leaves. Simon is chatting to colleagues when Sam arrives back. She comes in through the side entrance so that she can go to the ladies and check her face before anyone spots her. Now she sees a bunch of young men gathered around the desk in his office, looking intently at something on his phone, then bursting out laughing simultaneously. She pictures some gross meme, probably involving a young woman with unfeasibly large breasts. She is relieved that he is not in her cubicle, one buttock resting on the corner of her desk, his head tilted in fake concern. She stands for a moment, watching them, then drops her handbag and places the cream Chanel jacket on the back of her chair. She walks out, through accounting, past reception and down the narrow corridor to the loading bay. The vans are all out, and he is seated alone in the little office by the main shutters.
He has his back to her when she arrives, his hands linked behind his head as he gazes, apparently deep in thought, out of the window at the yard, his shoulders too broad for his navy blue company sweatshirt. Behind the office, suspended from the rafters, hangs a large black and yellow punch bag. She stops for a moment, gazing at him. She has a sudden memory of them dancing, his hand on her waist, his eyebrows raised in amused appreciation as she strutted in those shoes. The driver's office is warm and fuggy, thanks to an ancient bar heater in the corner, and the walls are lined with tachographs and whiteboards detailing the day's jobs, faded birthday cards, and new Uberprint memos. She is not sure she has been in here more than a handful of times in all the years she's worked there, and suddenly the office feels smaller than she remembers. Or maybe he is just bigger. He turns in his chair.
Sam, I didn't know you were... Have you got any gloves?
He blinks.
What? Gloves?
She says.
Boxing gloves. Have you got any here?
He follows her gaze out to the punch bag.
I've got mine, but they'll be too big for you.
Show me. He reaches under his desk and pulls out a kit bag containing two scuffed black gloves, which he holds up to her. She examines them briefly. She pulls them onto her fists, securing the Velcro with her teeth until they are as tight as they can go around her wrists. Then she walks out of the office and over to the punch bag. She stands in front of it for a moment and takes a breath, tightens her core, allows everything that has been spinning around her head to settle. And then she pulls her arm back from her shoulder and throws everything she has into a right-handed punch. The impact sends the bag wheeling backwards on its ropes. She meets it with her left, rooted through her feet, all her strength coming from her left shoulder so that it spins again. She hits it, again and again, hammering the leather, her hair working loose from its ponytail, her breath coming in short bursts, little gasps emerging from her mouth with each impact. She hits and she hits, not caring who sees her, not worrying if she looks daft attacking a punch bag in her good trousers and a next blouse. Joel, who had initially moved back in surprise, walks round to the other side and steadies the punch bag with his arm so that she can hit it harder, and she notes with gratification that increasingly he flinches at each impact, his body leaning in, his left foot sliding forward to give him greater purchase. Sam hits and hits until she feels something in her finally give. And then, abruptly, she stops, her hands dropping to her sides, suddenly aware of her heart racing, the trickle of sweat running down her back into her waistband. There is a silence, broken only by the creak of the punch bag swinging gently on its chain. She looks up at Joel, who is watching her, both hands still resting on the bag, as if he is not sure whether she is about to hit again.
You okay?
He says.
Miriam Price wants me to come in and talk to her, she says, panting.
Joel looks startled.
About a job? She adds.
They gaze steadily at each other. Sam feels sweat dripping into her eye and attempts to wipe it away with the back of her arm. Neither of them speaks.
I don't want you to leave, Joel says finally, dropping the punch bag. I don't want to leave, she says.
They stare at each other, and then, without thinking, she steps forward, takes his face between her boxing gloves, and kisses him. At the first touch of Joel's mouth, Sam's body goes into a kind of shock. She has kissed nobody but Phil in more than 25 years, and she is not sure even they have ever kissed like this. Everything about Joel is alien and delicious. He smells different, his lips are softer, his body harder, his hands on her hair, the suggestion of overwhelming strength. Joel's arms slide around her, her body melts into his, and the kisses grow deeper, more urgent, her gloved hands at his neck, her breath rapid. Time stalls. Everything around her disappears, so that it's just his lips, his skin, the heat of his body against hers. Her whole body feels as if it has become molten, melded to his, long dormant synapses springing to life. She wants to take off the gloves. She wants to feel his skin against her, smooth and warm. She wants to wrap herself completely around him. She wants to reach into his trousers and... She pulls back, her breath hard in her chest, her gloves raised to her face. And then she sees Ted. He is standing by the loading doors, his mouth slightly open as he sees them, a look of what she can only describe afterwards as horrified disappointment on his kind, fleshy face. "Joel, I... She stutters. She turns and runs back towards the office, wrestling the gloves off and hurling them behind her as she goes. Sam walks briskly through the cubicles until she reaches her own, her colour high, her sights fixed in front of her, sure that everyone in there must know what just happened. Her body feels as if it has been ignited, as if she's radiating heat, and her thoughts are churning and jumbled. She sits down in her chair a little shakily, staring unseeing at the screen. She has just kissed Joel. She has just kissed Joel. She wanted to do a lot more than just kiss Joel. She can still feel his mouth on hers, his tough, sinewy body against hers. She thinks of Ted's appalled expression, then abruptly lets out a half laugh, a strange high-pitched squeal, and puts both hands to her face, immediately mortified. What on earth has she done? Who has she become? She glances guiltily behind her, but nobody seems to have noticed. Heads are bowed. Marina is walking past with a mug of coffee. The photocopier by the fire exit door appears to be on the blink again. She jumps slightly as her phone buzzes. Joel. "You okay?" She stares at it. "I think so," she types with trembling fingers. "Did Ted say anything?" "Just that it was none of his business. He went straight out again." "You think I should go after him?" "No, no. I don't know. Maybe I should. I don't know what just happened." She glances up, checking to see if anyone has noticed, if anyone can sense that this is her, Sam Kemp, sneaking around locking lips with a work colleague. Was this almost having an affair? Was this where her life was heading? Did Ted think she was a terrible person? "Help me," she thinks, not sure who she is actually asking. And then she jumps out of her skin because a dark-haired woman is standing in the doorway to her cubicle, glaring at her and saying, in a loud American voice, "Where are my shoes, bitch?" Chapter 25. Nisha had walked unchallenged into the offices of Uberprint. The men gathered by the vans glanced at her, but nobody seemed to think it was unusual that she was walking straight through the back entrance. After a cursory glance at her legs, they turned back to their discussion. The office is a drab, the kind of place that might sell pet insurance or drain solutions, and she wrinkled her nose at the smell of stale carpet and machine coffee as she headed down a corridor that looked like it led to the main office. A young woman lifted her head from her phone at the reception desk, but didn't stop her, and Nisha pushed through a set of double doors, finding herself in a large space divided into grey cubicles. In the corner of the room, she saw a big, glass-windowed office containing a gathering of young men in cheap suits, while around her a vague hum of half-hearted industry emanated from the individual desks, people clicking on keyboards, murmuring into phones or sipping tea while chatting at the photocopier. She scanned the room, her bag clamped to her side. Then she spied a woman, hunched in one of the far cubicles as she took her seat, her badly tinted hair visible above the composite partitions. Nisha had stopped and stared. Nisha had not known what she would do when she finally confronted the woman who had caused so much trouble, a thief who also happens to hold the key to her future. But there was something about the shabbiness of her, the depressed slope of her shoulders that instantly infuriated her. "I have been bested by this," she thought as she strode across the office. Her heartbeat started a loud, insistent thumping in her ears, and suddenly she is in the cubicle, and the woman is spinning in her seat to face her, phone in a limp hand, her features rigid with shock. "What?" the woman is stammering. "What are you talking about?" She looks, Nisha notes, with some distant sense of gratification, genuinely terrified.
You stole my shoes at the gym. You stole my shoes and you've been wearing them. I've got you on CCTV and... Oh my God, is that my Chanel jacket?
The woman flushes to the roots of her hair, glances guiltily at the cream boucle jacket draped on the back of her office chair.
What the actual?
Nisha wrenches the jacket from the chair and checks the label. Where are my shoes? Where is my bag? What have you done with my things? I'm going to call the cops.
I didn't steal anything. It was an accident.
Oh, an accident. And instead of handing my stuff in, you decided to wear my shoes to a bar and bring my Chanel jacket to work? Sure, that's definitely an accident.
A small crowd has gathered around the cubicle. The woman is staring at her, her hands waving, palms up in front of her.
Look, I can explain. The gym was...
You have no idea the trouble you've caused. Bet you thought I'd never find you, right? Well, you have no idea who you're dealing with.
A man appears at the entrance of the cubicle. Gelled hair, cheap suit, bringing with him a slightly self-conscious air of authority.
What's going on here?
What's going on? Ask her, the shoe thief.
I told you, I didn't know whose they were. I must have picked up the wrong bag, and when I went back to return them, they were...
I want my shoes.
The man turns to Sam.
Sam, what's going on?
The woman turns to him.
Simon, I can explain this. When I went to the gym, the day you saw me in the flip-flops, there was a mix-up with the bags and...
And you stole them.
That's it.
That's what?
You're fired.
The room falls silent.
What?
You're fired.
He lifts his voice slightly as if to make sure everyone in the room can hear his decision.
With immediate effect. We can't have a thief in the office. You're repeatedly bringing Uberprint into disrepute. You've had plenty of warnings and this is it. Get your things and go.
He visibly puffs up, glances to his side as if waiting for signs of approval from the people watching. Nisha feels a vague sense of dismay. She hates guys like him, but the woman has brought it on herself.
Simon, mate.
A man with dreadlocks has stepped forward. You can't fire Sam for a simple mix-up. She told us in the van when we picked her up that she had the wrong bag, but we...
Not interested,
says Simon, his mouth pressed into a thin line of disapproval and barely suppressed pleasure.
Not interested. This lady here has been quite clear about what actually happened, and this is not the kind of behaviour I'm prepared to tolerate. I've had enough problems with Sam these past weeks, and this is the final straw.
But
we're done here. Everyone go back to work. The show's over. Sam, gather your belongings and I'll get security to escort you out. HR will sort out your P45.
Even Nisha is a little taken aback by this. There is a low murmur of unease among the other workers. They hesitate and exchange glances, but nobody seems willing to challenge the man's authority, and eventually, uncomfortably, they melt away. The dreadlocked man is the last to leave. He murmurs something into the woman's ear, but she barely registers it. She looks grey with shock, starts dumbly gathering her things. Nisha will not let her discomfort colour what has just happened. She is in the right. She was not the person who stole somebody's belongings. All she has done is try to get her things back.
I'll be waiting outside, Nisha says when the man finally leaves, flanked by several other men in cheap suits.
I'll need my shoes and bag too, Sam.
Sam collects her framed pictures and puts them into a box that Marina brings over, her fingers slipping so that she drops one on the floor with a clatter that seems to echo around the office. Marina mutters, I'm so sorry, as she puts the cardboard box on the desk, but the accusation of thief has clearly done something to the atmosphere, and Marina gives her a slightly wary, confused look as she leaves. The cubicles of her co-workers are completely silent around her. Sam cannot bear to look up. She knows Simon and his mates will be watching from his office, muttering to each other, imagines the whispered conversations between her workmates. She is mortified, her ears ringing with that woman's words. She gathers up the last of her things, and Lewis, the security officer from downstairs, appears. He rubs the back of his head and shifts his weight from one foot to the other, as if he is not sure what to do. She glances at him and he pulls an awkward, slightly embarrassed face, then gestures towards the corridor. It is only when the doors open, feels the cold air hit her face and sees the American woman standing there stubbing out a cigarette that it hits home. I've lost my job. I've actually lost my job. And she puts the box on the ground and picks up her phone to call the only person she can think will be able to get her through this. Andrea? Sam has no car, and she does not want to be stuck in a taxi with this crazy woman who is giving off scary, aggressive vibes, so she begins to walk, the woman maintaining a tail exactly 2 steps behind her. She is wearing her Chanel jacket, checking the sleeves ostentatiously for signs of dirt or damage.
I'm not going anywhere, lady, just so you know.
I know, says Sam, staring straight ahead. I'm just walking home. Sam puts one foot in front of the other, her head still ringing with Simon's words, the sight of her workmates' faces as everything they thought they knew about her began to slip away. She should have made more of an effort to return the shoes. She should have made it a priority. And now she has lost everything.
And my stuff had better be at your house.
It isn't my house. Look, I did try to return your bag. The gym was closed until further notice.
I'm not interested.
Okay, well, I'm just telling you. I'm not a thief.
Says the woman with my Chanel jacket slung over the back of her chair.
Sam spins around, tears in her eyes. I had an important meeting today, okay? I had a meeting with someone I was trying to impress, and I thought it wouldn't hurt if I just wore it once. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay, so you're Mother Teresa? Whatever.
What?
Just get me my shoes. I don't care what you are. I just go on the evidence.
The evidence.
Sam keeps seeing Simon's face, the way his lip curled with a kind of satisfaction as he called her a thief.
She has lost her job. She has actually lost her job.
And of course, he won't be obliged to give her a reference, she thinks, and her stomach begins to hurt. She will never get another job. Phil and Kat will be out on the streets with her. They will end up in a tiny bed and breakfast room, the kind of place the government puts refugees, with one electric ring to cook on and communal toilets, or they will have to move in with her parents, and everyone will blame her, and they will have every right to. How has she ended up in such a mess? They walk on in silence for 2 more streets until Sam turns and stops.
Can you at least not walk 2 steps behind me like some kind of security guard? It's unnerving. You really think I'm going to run away, lugging this bloody box?
I don't know you, lady. You could try anything. You could be a top-class sprinter for all I know.
Do I look like a top-class sprinter?
You don't look like a thief, but somehow that happened. Oh, for God's sake!
Sam puts the box down and presses her palms into her eyes for a moment, trying to contain the panic attack that is building in her chest. When she opens them again, the woman is staring at her. After a couple of minutes, however, she does start walking alongside her. The walk continues like this for some time. Sam is grateful for her sturdy shoes, though the box weighs heavy in her arms, with all the photo frames of her family, and she has to keep pausing to adjust the weight. Her elbows hurt, and then her lower back. The American woman strides effortlessly beside her in, Sam realizes with some surprise, her own flat black shoes. It is a half-hour walk that feels endless. She needs Andrea. She just needs to see Andrea's face and feel her arms around her and know that something in this world is constant and good, that someone knows she is not a bad person. Finally, they turn into her street, and she notes that Andrea's little blue Nissan Micra is outside, and the relief she feels at the sight of it causes a huge sob to hiccup out of her chest, so that the American woman gives her a sharp, quizzical look.
Here. We're here,
Sam mumbles and walks past the camper van, where Phil is noisily sanding a bumper on the roadside wearing a pair of plastic goggles. He does not look up. Sam wrestles the door open. She drops the box in the hallway and heads straight upstairs, ignoring the dog's delighted welcome. She does not want this woman here a moment longer than is necessary. She pushes open her bedroom door, heads to the wardrobe, and hauls out the black Marc Jacobs bag. She hoiks the handles over her shoulder and walks back downstairs.
The woman is standing by the front door watching Phil, her arms folded across her chest. She looks up when Sam appears and her eyes switch immediately to the bag.
At last, she says and pulls it from Sam's arm. Is everything in there?
Of course, says Sam.
The woman gazes at her for a moment. I'm going to check.
Fine.
Sam walks away back along the corridor to the kitchen. And there is Andrea, sitting at the table, her head wrapped in a new bright pink paisley wrap. She climbs heavily to her feet when she sees Sam. What's going on, lovely? And suddenly Sam is in her arms, her head buried in Andrea's neck, sobbing. And even as she sobs, she feels how frail Andrea still is, the boniness of her shoulder, and it makes her even more grief-stricken.
I lost my job, she says.
Andrea pulls back to look at her. You're kidding.
He got me out. He finally got me out. It's all because of a stupid misunderstanding, but I don't know what I'm going to do. Phil isn't talking to me, and I don't know what he's going to say when he finds out.
Andrea's face is wrinkled with sympathy. She strokes Sam's hair. We'll work it out. Don't worry, Sam. We'll work this out. You'll be okay. And then Andrea flinches as the American woman strides into the kitchen, rage sparking off her like electricity.
Where are my fucking shoes?
Sam turns to look at her.
What?
Where are my shoes?
They're in the bag, I told you.
Who are you? Says Andrea, who suddenly looks a lot less frail.
I'm the person whose shoes this bitch stole, says the American woman. Don't you dare talk like that in my friend's kitchen. Tone down your language.
Andrea's voice cuts through the air like ice, and Sam notices a faint flicker pass across the American woman's face.
They must be in there, Sam says, wiping her eyes.
The woman holds out the gaping bag, unzipped along its length.
Yeah? Want to show me?
Sam blinks. The shoes are gone. She takes a step forward, tentatively moves the t-shirt from the bottom. She's right. The shoes are not there. Sam's head is racing.
I don't get it. They've been in there all the time.
Phil walks in, lifting the goggles from his face. He looks at Sam and doesn't smile. Then he sees the American woman and Andrea, and perhaps detects some strange vibration in the atmosphere.
Hello.
He looks at the American woman, waiting for an explanation.
Phil, have you seen a pair of red shoes? They were in this bag?
His face closes over.
Your new high heels? The tarty ones?
Tarty? They're Christian Louboutin, says the American woman, and they're mine.
Phil looks at Sam.
They weren't your shoes.
No, hang on. How did you know about the shoes?
Kat saw you wearing them.
He lifts his chin and stares at her. When you were out with your lover? Sam stares back. The air in the kitchen grows very still. And suddenly Phil's coldness, his determination not to spend any time with her, makes sense. She feels herself flush.
I don't have a lover.
She doesn't have a lover. She's been miserable for months because you won't engage with her. Don't be ridiculous, Phil. Andrea gazes at Sam and notes the brief silence, the slow flush of colour on Sam's neck. She looks from one to the other.
Oh, well, this is interesting.
I haven't touched the shoes, says Phil.
Well, I did. I took them out to the van because I didn't want them in the house, but then Kat asked where they were. I think maybe she wanted to borrow them.
Great, says Nisha. So now my shoes are being passed around from scuzzy foot to scuzzy foot. Perfect.
Sam is still staring at her husband.
I'm not having an affair.
Aren't you?
No. Why would you think that?
Well, for one thing, you've changed.
You don't have time for me anymore.
Phil,
you've spent months welded to the sofa. You don't notice if I'm alive or dead most of the time.
And you've been coming home all glowing and sweaty.
I've been boxing. I go boxing 3 times a week.
Boxing? In high heels? Nice try.
What?
Hello? Can we stay on track, please? I don't care who she's fooling around with. I want my damn shoes.
Sam turns to Nisha.
I'll pay you for the shoes. I'm sorry.
I don't want your money.
Don't you understand? I need those shoes.
Andrea pulls out her phone. Shouldn't we just call Kat?
Sam stands frozen as Andrea dials her daughter. She cannot stop staring at Phil. His gaze flickers onto and away from her face. She can see the uncertainty as he tries to work out whether she is telling the truth, and it feels like a blow.
Hey, lovey, how are you?
Good.
Good. Listen, we've got a bit of an issue at home, and I just wanted to ask, where are the red shoes from your mum's wardrobe?
The room falls silent as Andrea, her voice calm and reassuring, listens to the inaudible voice at the other end.
I know, lovely. There's been a bit of a misunderstanding.
So where did you take them?
I know.
You did?
Let me just write that down.
Okay.
She ends the call with more reassurances, a
yeah, love you,
and a see you soon.
Then Andrea lets out a breath and looks up at the waiting faces.
She thought you were having an affair and she didn't like you wearing them.
Plus she says they're a repulsive symbol of patriarchal oppression and she didn't want them in the house.
So?
The American woman's voice is brisk.
So she took them to a charity shop. It's one near her college.
She took my shoes to a Goodwill store?
The American woman throws her hands into the air.
Oh, this just gets better.
When?
Says Sam weakly.
Yesterday afternoon. Look, don't panic. If we head over now, maybe we'll be able to get them back.